This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled weekend. Are you making plans, or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a conversation with a celebrated New Orleans jazz vocalist, a thought-provoking exhibit that sheds light on important issues, or an inside look at our growing local film industry, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. I'm your host, Diane Mack. Jermaine Basil is one of New Orleans' most accomplished musicians, a musician whose instrument of choice is her voice. She has also exercised a profound effect on youngsters in Southeast Louisiana as a teacher through a dozen years in Thibodaux and an even longer tenure at Xavier Prep in New Orleans. Jermaine Basil recently sat down with WWNO's Fred Kasten for the Talkin' Jazz interview series at the old U.S. Mint and talked about some of her musical influences and the place that teaching has occupied in her life.
Jermaine Basil grew up in New Orleans' 7th Ward in a home with a large extended family and a piano.
My grandmother used to like to play the hymns and sing the hymns that she played. My aunts and uncles played the popular songs of the day. My mother liked to play the marches, you know. I mean, so you had the piano going all of the time, because at that time we didn't have the record things and that we have today. But there was always music in the house. Somebody was playing something, and I started, like little children do, get to the piano and pick out whatever you hear. And my father used to play a song called Sweet Sue. That was the first song that I learned how to play, you know, get in the corner and pick it out.
Formal musical training commenced for Jermaine Basil a few years after her family moved to the 6th Ward, a.k.a. Treme.
One day, I must have been maybe around 11 or 12 years old, and my mother told me to come straight home from school. Don't stop along the way, you know, like children walk and you drag along, you play and all of this. And mother said, come straight home from school because we have somewhere to go. Well, I thought that meant we were going shopping, you know. But we didn't go shopping. She brought me up to Xavier University. And Xavier University had what was called the Junior School of Music. And this was a school of music for children. And I didn't know I was going for a piano lesson. You know, at that time, you didn't question things, you know. But anyway, mother took me up to Xavier, and I was enrolled in the Junior School of Music. That's where the formal training began, and that's where I met many, many wonderful youngsters who turned out to be great musicians and performers and teachers and all of that. We didn't know we were going to go that way, but that was the exposure. And while I was there, the head of the program suggested that I enroll in a vocal class. So I had the piano and the vocal, and she decided that I should learn to play the bass to play with the orchestra. So, 12, 13 years old, you just follow instructions, you know. The teacher says do such, and you do that, you know. Of course, I didn't know that she had already discussed this with my parents, you know. But anyway, it ended up with the voice lessons, the piano, and the bass.
Fellow students at the Xavier Junior School included great pianists Edward Frank and Ellis Marcellus, and top-notch bassist Richard Payne. The program was run by the very accomplished and demanding Sister Mary Letitia.
She is the one, when you hear that little sound that I make. She is the one that demonstrated that to the orchestra. When we were playing and she wanted something done, she wanted to show the trumpets or trombones, the brass people, how to do a certain thing. She would do that little thing, you know. Uh-huh. And when I started doing gigs, I found myself doing that.
Going back to your roots.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, all of those influences, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, you told me one time that she was had very high expectations for her students.
She did. She didn't accept anything less than your best. And that rubbed off on me, too, because not only did I try to do my very best, but when I got into the classroom, I didn't accept less than the best. You know, whatever your best was, that's what I wanted.
The music Jermaine Basel studied and played at the Xavier Junior School and later at Xavier University, where she earned a degree in music education, was mostly classical. Her jazz education started at home.
One of my brothers was very much into the jazz, and that got me involved in it, and we started listening to Stan Kenton and Woody Herman's Third Herd and Dave Brubeck and Charlie Parker and, you know, all of those people. We were listening to vocalists, Ella and Sarah and, you know, Betty Carter, all of these people. So that was the listening. And I want to say that my brother had a group of friends who were musicians like Johnny Fernandez, Bill Fisher, and, you know, those guys. And those guys would come to our house to listen to music. You know, it was the weirdest thing. You know, five or six guys sitting in the living room and just recording after recording is being played. Well, boys. So I'm sitting in the room with them, you know. I mean, that was nice.
Yeah.
But and I was also interested in the music. But my mom used to come and peep to see if anything was going on because it was so quiet. Nobody talked. You know, you didn't talk while the record was playing. And after you listened to it, you might say, well, did you hear what he did on this band? I didn't know what they were talking about, and I just listened, you know. Yeah. Can I get a glass of water, please? I mean, it was just so soft that they would speak. So my mother, you know, used to come and see what was going on because all she heard was the music, no conversations. But that was intense listening. And that was a lesson I learned. You have to listen. When you're doing music, you have to listen. Not only listen to yourself, but you must listen to everything that's going on.
Jermaine Basel became a polished, exuberant, engaging, utterly professional performer. But performance played second fiddle to teaching for her through a long career of music education that began in Thibodaux right after she completed her degree at Xavier.
It was very special. And I actually think that teaching is my calling. You know, I did the thing on the side, you know. I did the gigs on the side because that was the fun part. But it was never a job. I didn't even try to pursue that as a career because the teaching is the thing.
Jermaine Basel has retired from teaching, but she continues to pursue her hobby of making great music with performances most Sunday nights at 8 in the Jazz Playhouse at the Royal Sonesta. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Canston.
It seems that we have met like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then, but I can't remember where or where. The clothes you're wearing are the clothes you wore. The smile you were smiling, you were smiling.
In addition to her regular Sunday sets at the Royal Sonesta, Jermaine Basel will also perform Friday night, February 1st at Snug Harbor. Today's interview with her was made possible in part thanks to support from the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park, which presents the live interview series, Talkin' Jazz with Fred Gaston. the last Friday afternoon of each month at 2 p.m. in the third floor auditorium of the old U.S. Mint. The series continues with Fred's interview of great New Orleans drummer and composer Herlin Reilly, this Friday at 2. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO. I'm Diane Mack. In the St. Claude Arts District, installation artist Cynthia Scott sheds some light on local issues as she seeks to open viewers' minds to opposing thoughts in her latest exhibit, Let There Be Lumières.
If I were speaking French correctly, I would not pronounce the S on the end, but in this context, it's exactly correct because I'm not saying let there be light, I'm saying let there be lights, which there are in this show.
Plenty of them. Scott uses points of light to invite you to explore a series of sculptures made from recycled objects. The light illuminating her works from within are the only lights in the small gallery, an artist collaborative called Staple Goods in the 1300 block of St. Rock at North Villery. As Scott explores light and darkness in this unique exhibit, she is seeking to coax viewers to open their minds to all sides of an issue, to investigate what lies beneath the initial beauty that attracts one to her works.
I am exploring dichotomies. I'm exploring the fact that we can't have light without darkness. If it were light all the time, we wouldn't know it was light because there would be nothing to compare it against. And I think there's a predilection in society to ascribe characteristics of goodness to light and badness to dark. But that doesn't make any sense because they're two sides of the same physical dynamic. In each of these pieces, each of which is, in fact, a light, I've used imagery of two different types. I've set up dichotomies in each piece. There are images which could be considered by some to be positive and perhaps negative. But you can flip it as well. And, for instance, there's one piece called Cranes in the Sky. Apologies to Mr. Blakely. There are images of cranes silhouetted against a sky, and there are also images of New Orleans houses with their beautiful bright colors and their shutters and their wonderful paint jobs and their wonderful architecture. And you can look at the cranes in the sky as being a positive element to our culture right now, that rebuilding is taking place. That's great. It's wonderful. You could also look at it as how many old historic buildings are being knocked down that perhaps shouldn't be. On the other hand, you could look at the old buildings and say they're completely outdated. They're not habitable. Who can live in a one-room shotgun anymore? We need new plumbing. We need modernization. So everything has a positive and negative side. And so I want people to contemplate the pieces and go back and forth between that dichotomy and look at the issues for themselves.
Scott moves from the issue of post-Katrina recovery to the oil industry in the Gulf of Mexico.
It's called Drill Birdie Drill. I have photographs of oil rigs in the ocean. They're actually quite beautiful photographs. Of course, there's all that blue water, and I've pumped up the saturation of the photographs so that the oil rigs themselves are sometimes brightly colored, and I have a number of those together in aggregate. And then I have photographs of pelicans. They're living pelicans. They're not oil-soaked. They're just nicely flying around. I wanted people to contemplate both sides of all issues. And it cannot be denied that the oil industry has provided a healthy living for many people in this state and across the Gulf South and in other parts of the country as well. So for every argument that it's doing harm, which can certainly be made, I didn't want to be pointing the finger, but I do want people to draw their own conclusions and look at all the issues from all the sides.
Scott uses fabric, photos, paint, glass, and light in her sculptures. Some hang from the ceiling, some are on pedestals, and one takes up an entire wall. Scott, who is primarily known as an installation artist, knew early on that art was her calling growing up in New York.
My parents say that when I was 2, they took me to the circus and I came home and drew a well-articulated drawing of the elephants in a chain holding each other's tails with trunks. And They pronounced me a genius, 2-year-old, and I was very blessed that from the earliest day they supplied me with materials with which to work. And as soon as I was old enough, I was enrolled in classes at the Art Gallery in Rochester, New York, and Memorial Art Gallery. And they have allowed me to follow my muse ever since. I attended Rhode Island School of Design for my undergraduate degree and Tulane for my master's. It's something that I've always done. It's a through line in my life, even though I've taken side digressions to other things.
Scott now calls New Orleans home, and in addition to creating art, she is weekend announcer here at WWNO. She invites viewers to contemplate value judgments as she plays with light and darkness in her latest work, Let There Be Lumieres, on view at Staple Goods, 1340 St. Rock Avenue through February 3rd. The gallery is open on Saturdays and Sundays from noon to 5 p.m. Lights, camera, action. WWNO, in collaboration with NOLAV.com, brings you Take 5. It's an inside look into our growing local film industry with the people shaping it. Brian Friedman reports on how the Mayor's Office of Cultural Economy continues to incentivize our city.
While 1938's The Buccaneer generally isn't mentioned among director Cecil B. DeMille's greatest works, and in fact is probably better known for its 1958 remake starring the famously bald Yul Brynner, it did signal the beginning of major motion film production in New Orleans. For the next 60 years, however, that production could best be described as sporadic, with a Pelican Brief or Big Easy causing a minor stir in town every so often. But that would change 10 years ago.
The first year in 2002, there was maybe 4 films, feature films and television shows that chose New Orleans. And now you're looking at 2004 with 16, and then it just continued to increase and increase and increase. So now, last year, we had 46 feature film and television shows choose New Orleans for their filming destination. And so you're building an industry.
That's Katie Williams, director of Film New Orleans in the Mayor's Office of Cultural Economy, talking about the exponential growth of the local film industry. And that's been good for the local economy, as businesses have sprouted up to support the growing industry.
So everything from a camera house to a prop house to costuming, from portalettes to security, catering, pretty much anything a movie needs at this point in the city can be found locally, which is incredible. You know, so when a movie comes here, they're not bringing much. They're bringing their what we call the above the line, which is their directors, their producers, the people who are kind of setting the creative vision. But every crew on below the line, which tends to be about 150 to 200 people for every movie, are local citizens, our neighbors, our coworkers that are working in this industry and providing them not only the services but also the skills.
Over the years, other states have sought to mimic Louisiana's success by offering similar tax credit programs, but it hadn't seemed to slow the local industry's growth. Williams cites the relative simplicity of the Louisiana program, which gives a clear, across-the-board 30% tax credit for any Louisiana expenditure, plus an additional 5% for any local crew hire as part of the equation. The fact that Louisiana credits are transferable and non-capped also is a draw, but it also might go beyond numbers.
I think both crew and talent like to be here. They enjoy our culture. They enjoy the music and the food, the hotels, the accommodations. I mean, I think we see all the time that some people prefer to go downtown and stay at one of our beautiful hotels, but some of them would rather stay in a home in the Garden District or in the French Quarter or further uptown. And so I think there's that paired with the idea that when they come here, for whatever reason, New Orleanians aren't crazy. Tom Cruise can walk the French Quarter and no one's going to run him down for an autograph. You know, Brad Pitt and Angelina can have a home here and no one's going to chase down Brad Pitt on his bicycle.
As for the future, Williams says she sees continued growth from within.
The hope is that as we continue to grow our infrastructure and our community here, that you'll see success coming out of our local industry. You know, having a movie that's written and produced and directed by a local resident of the state of Louisiana.
Williams points to the success of the locally produced Beasts of the Southern Wild, which has earned acclaim at the Sundance Film Festival and beyond, as an example.
You had a film that was written about us by someone who was a part of this community that was produced and written and done wholly out of here. So I think that's the point of the credits. That's what the hope at the end of the game is to create a community that has not only that creative juice to really put together a project that way, but at this point now we have all the infrastructure, all the crew to support that project.
To learn more about the film industry in New Orleans, go to wwno.org or nolavie.com. That's NOLAVIE.com. For WWNO, I'm Brian Friedman.
Brian Friedman is a writer in New Orleans. We have something extra for you in our Lagniap Corner. The LPO, in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection, is presenting Envisioning Louisiana, an LPO concert that is part of a series examining the state's contributions to classical music. The concert takes place tomorrow night at 7:30 in St. Louis Cathedral. Doors open at 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. There is also a live video webcast at lpomusic.com. And the Ashe Cultural Arts Center is hosting Loving Your Enemies, a commemorative art exhibition celebrating the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights movement, and those working to further peace and human understanding. The exhibit is presented by the New Orleans chapter of the National Conference of Artists in partnership with the New Orleans African American Museum of Art, Culture, and History. Loving Your Enemies features work by local and national artists and is on view through March 30th at the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, 1712 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. It is free and open to the public. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next week at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.